Hey guys, it's Emma
and Shannon,
and welcome back to our podcast, She's an Engineer.
Happy fall, everyone. In today's episode, we're going to talk about how trees and plants prepare for winter. So first, going to discuss why trees and plants have to prepare for the colder seasons, and then how they do it, along with the changing of leaves and how weather may change how leaves color in the fall. So let's just dive into it, and Emma's going to start off explaining why leaves fall off of trees during autumn.
Yes. So in autumn, trees are preparing for the winter time, and winter is a certainty that all vegetation in temperate zones must face each year. So we're not talking about other climates that are warm all year round or are cool all year round. Those are different, but we're mostly talking about, like, let's say like the Northeast or where Shannon's living, like the Pacific Northwest, and obviously other areas of the world who have different climates for different seasons. So perennial plants, including trees, they have to have some sort of protection to survive freezing temperatures and other harsh wintertime influences. And so the stems, the twigs, and the buds are equipped to survive extreme cold so that they can reawaken when spring comes and there's another growing season. But the leaf tissues, which are much more fragile and delicate than a stem or a twig, would freeze in winter, so the plants must either toughen up and protect their leaves or dispose of them so that they don't freeze off and harm the plants in the winter. There are certain plants like evergreens, pines, spruces, cedars, firs, and other plants or other trees that are able to survive winter because they have toughened up. So evergreens, if you've seen an evergreen, like a Christmas tree, they have like needle-like leaves, or other trees have scale-like foliage that are covered with a heavy wax coating. And so the fluid also inside their cells contains substances that also resist freezing. And so the foliage of evergreens can safely withstand all but the severest winter conditions, such as those in the Arctic. And then these needles can survive for a couple years at least, but it also eventually fall because of old age. There are also broadleaf trees, which are trees that don't have needles or scale-like leaves. And those are like the trees that we typically see that change color during the fall time. So they are tender and vulnerable to damage. They're typically broad and thin, and they're not protected by any thick coverings. And then the fluid in the cells of these leaves is also usually a thin, watery sap that freezes readily, which makes them vulnerable in the winter when temperatures fall below freezing. And so these tissues are unable to undergo wintertime conditions, and they must be sealed off and shed to ensure that the plant can continue to survive throughout the winter. And then these needles and leaves that fall are obviously not wasted. They decompose and they restock the soil with nutrients and make up part of the spongy humus layer of the forest floor that absorbs and holds rainfall. So they become part of the ecosystem again. And then fallen leaves can also become food for numerous soil organisms that are vital to the forest ecosystem.
Awesome. And now we're going to transition into how do plants prepare for winter. So similar to bears, trees and plants, they slow down their metabolisms and enter a state of dormancy, which I actually wanted to mention that right now the National Park Service is doing a fat bear competition, and they have pictures of bears in some of their national parks, especially in Alaska, that are getting really fat. They're eating a lot of food, so they're able to survive the winter. And so they do this like bracketed competition of all the fat bears, and then there's a winner.
I love that. Which is interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty funny seeing the pictures. And I wanted to mention, technically, bears don't hibernate. They slow down their heart rate and so they can survive the winter, and they wake up a few times and move around their den Yeah, so technically it's not hibernating, but they do slow down their metabolism and heart rate to survive. Okay, so excess sugars made during the summer are concentrated in the plant cells and act like a form of antifreeze. When water from the cells, which could freeze and cause them to burst, moves outside the cell walls where it can safely freeze without damaging the cells. As it thaws, water can be reabsorbed by the plant cells and prevent dehydration. This method of moving water in and out of the cells helps plants to not only survive the cold, but also extreme weather such as heat and drought. While all seems dormant above the ground, a natural process of adaptation is happening well below the soil. The roots continue to develop and thrive, keeping plants fed with stored up starches until warm weather returns. Soil temps are usually much higher than the air temperature in winter. A layer of mulch or snow acts like a blanket to keep extreme cold from penetrating too far and damaging the roots. More importantly, it can protect the ground from rapid freezing and thawing that can harm the roots and encourage unseasonable new growth, which is susceptible to a sudden freeze. Different plants prepare for winter very differently. Some plants, including many garden flowers and vegetables, are called annuals, which means they complete their life cycle in one growing season. So they will die off in the fall or winter when temperatures get below freezing. And right before that, they often drop their seeds. You can keep those seeds, but you'll have to replant it in the next growing season. There's also perennials, which can live for two or more years. And this category includes trees and shrubs, as well as herbaceous plants with soft, fleshy stems. When winter comes, the woody parts of trees and shrubs that are perennials can survive the cold. The above-ground parts of these herbaceous plants, like the leaves and stalks, will die off, but the underground parts, the roots or bulbs, will remain alive. In the winter, the plants rest and live off the stored food until spring. So also the evergreen trees, which, as Emma mentioned, they keep most of their leaves slash needles during the winter, and their needles are special and resistant to cold and moisture loss. These include pines and fir trees that have long, thin needles. There's also some plants like holly or rhododendron, which have broad leaves with tough, waxy surfaces. And on very cold, dry days, these leaves sometimes curl up to reduce their exposure.
And so how do leaves actually change colors? So first we're going to talk about the two types of trees. So there are two types of trees, deciduous and coniferous, and the trees that have leaves that change color in the fall are deciduous trees. They usually have large, broad leaves, as we talked about before. And then coniferous trees include evergreen trees with needles, which stay green to continue the photosynthesis process throughout the winter. So most of the year, these leaves are green because of the chlorophyll they use to absorb energy from sunlight during photosynthesis, and then the leaves then convert the energy into sugars to feed the tree. But then as the seasons change, temperatures drop and days get shorter, the trees get less direct sunlight and the chlorophyll in the leaves breaks down. And as we said, the chlorophyll is basically like the green pigment that makes the leaves green. And so if you take away the chlorophyll, it will reveal the yellow and orange pigments that were already in the leaves but were masked during the warmer months by the green pigment of chlorophyll. And then darker red leaves are a result of a chemical change. So sugars can get trapped in the leaves and they can produce new pigments called anthocyanins that weren't part of the leaf in the growing season. And so in the presence of bright light, the sugar trapped in the leaves form these red pigments. So the brighter the light, the greater the production of these anthocyanins, and the more brilliant the colors we see. When the days of autumn are bright and cool and the nights are chilly but not freezing, the brightest foliage colors will develop. And familiar trees with these red or scarlet leaves are red maples, dogwood, red oak, scarlet oak, and sassafras. And then some leaves of some species, like elms, they just shrivel up and fall, and then they don't really have that much color underneath that green pigment, and so they're mostly just brown, and they die, and they fall off the trees. And then the timing of the color change can also vary by the species of the tree. So, for example, sourwood in southern forests can become vividly colorful in late summer while all the other species are still very green. And then oaks put on their colors long after other species have already shed their leaves. So different seasons and different temperatures for different species of trees. And then these differences in timing seems to be genetically inherited. And so for a particular species at the same latitude, they'll show the same coloration in the cool temperatures of high mountain elevations at about the same time it does in warmer lowlands.
Mm-hmm. And there's a few different pigments which are associated with the different color variations. So there's carotenoids, which produce yellow, orange, and brown colors in things such as corn, carrots, and daffodils, as well as buttercups and bananas. There's anthocyanin, which gives color to such familiar things such as cranberries, red apples, Concord grapes, blueberries, cherries, strawberries, and plums. And they are water soluble and appear in a watery liquid of leaf cells. And then there is chlorophyll, which gives the basic green color and is necessary for photosynthesis, the chemical reaction that enables plants to use sunlight to manufacture the sugars for their food. So trees in temperate zones store their sugars for the winter dormant period, and both chlorophyll and carotenoids are present in the chloroplasts of the leaf cells throughout the growing season. Most anthocyanins are produced in the autumn in response to the bright light and excess plant sugars within the leaf cells. In early autumn, in response to the shortening days and declining intensity of sunlight, leaves begin the process leading up to their fall. The veins that carry fluids into and out of the leaves gradually close off as a layer of cells forms at the base of each leaf. These clogged veins trap the sugars in the leaf and promote production of anthocyanin. Once the separation layer is complete and the connecting tissues are sealed off, the leaf is ready to fall. So something that I think is really interesting is, depending on where you're living in the temperate climate, so across the U.S., north, south, there's different peak fall foliage times. And so there's a pretty cool map that we'll link here in the description, but it was created by smokymountains.com. So you can see approximately when you're going to get peak fall foliage, which is pretty cool. And at least right now in Boise, I think we're starting, like, we're in the early stages. A lot of trees, or there's like a few trees here that are starting to change color, but we're not to the peak time yet.
Yeah, I don't think it's peak time in New Jersey either, but I have definitely seen a little bit of color changes. But as we talked about before, so Boise and New Jersey are in the same hardiness zone on the hardiness zone map. And so the same type of plants would thrive in the climate that we're both in. Yes. And then lastly, we're just going to talk about the different weather that can affect the color of the leaves. And so the amount and brilliance of the colors that develop in any particular autumn season are related to weather conditions that occur before and during the time the chlorophyll in the leaves is dwindling. So temperature and moisture are the main influences for this. So a succession of warm sunny days and cool, crisp, but not freezing nights seems to bring about the most spectacular color displays. And so during these days, lots of sugars are produced in the leaves, but the cool nights and the gradual closing of veins going into the leaf prevent these sugars from moving out. And so these conditions, lots of sugar and lots of light, they spur production of anthocyanin pigments, as we talked about before, which tints reds, purples, and crimson. And because carotenoids are always present in leaves, the yellow and gold colors remain fairly constant from year to year. And so the type of temperature that you get in like the summer and in the fall don't really change the amount of yellow or gold pigments that you'll see on the trees. And then the amount of moisture in the soil also affects autumn colors. So like the weather, soil moisture varies greatly from year to year. And The countless combinations of these two highly variable factors assure that no two autumns can be exactly alike. So late spring or severe summer drought can delay the onset of fall color by a few weeks. So that's something good to know. Mm-hmm. A warm period during fall will also lower the intensity of autumn colors because, as we said before, they won't be able to, like, close the veins as well.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes. And then a warm, wet spring, favorable summer weather, and warm, sunny fall days with cool nights should produce the most brilliant autumn colors.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I wonder which area of the country has the best fall foliage.
I was actually looking this up, and there's a few different places that they recommend. Acadia National Park has okay. really good fall foliage. They were saying Denver, Colorado, and then some areas in the Smoky Mountains, along with the Midwest. I think the Midwest has an underrated fall because there's a lot of deciduous trees out there and deciduous forests, and it's just really pretty in the fall. Out here in Boise itself, there's a lot of deciduous trees, but actually in the mountains, they're all coniferous. So it's really not as impressive in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they say Midwest, do you think that includes Pittsburgh? Or is that mostly like Ohio and like that area?
I was thinking Ohio and Michigan, especially around the Great Lakes region, but I'm sure it's pretty good in Pittsburgh too.
Yeah, we just didn't see that many trees because we were, like, in the heart of the city. Mm-hmm. So there weren't as many plants. So, yeah, I find that really interesting. So now we know the best places to go if you want to see good fall foliage. But you have to time it well with the map. And your moisture and temperatures have to be exactly right. But I'm sure it's good, like, every year.
Mm-hmm. I think so. It is really interesting because I've lived in Boise. I think this will be my third fall here. And normally we'll hit the peak fall foliage before my family in Ohio. I think it's just because our summers are really warm and hot. And then once the temperature starts to go down, the leaves start to change. But yeah, Ohio will hit it like a week or two later after here.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's probably because like here, I think, like, in New Jersey, Boise also probably just, like, has, like, a sudden change of, like, temperature, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, for the most part. Yeah, like, 190 degrees, and then it goes down to 60s, 70s.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
During the day.
And that's exactly what we were just talking about. So, like, mm-hmm. the best fall foliage is if you have, like, hot days and cool nights.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So,
yeah. Okay, well, I thought this was really interesting. I have never really thought that much about fall foliage before researching this episode. But our next episode will hopefully be our third year podiversary episode. So we're still thinking about topics for that, but let us know if you have any specific topic that you want us to talk about.
Yes, and we hope you enjoyed this episode and enjoy some very colorful fall leaves this autumn. And we'll see you again in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.